in these shoes and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter of a pound, but I'm busted. I got a cow that went by and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that gets bigger each day. The county's gonna haul my belongings away, cause I'm busted.
Well, we're all singing the financial blues these days as the American economy lurches toward recession. Housing prices are sagging, major lenders post huge losses. That's the big picture. If you're like most Americans, you've been feeling pinched for a while now. Too many bills, not enough cash, credit card debts that just won't go away. Maybe even worse, personal bankruptcy and home foreclosure rates have soared in the past few years. How is it that so many people in the richest nation on earth are having so much trouble with money? I'm Ann Strangechamp, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today. If you've ever maxed out a credit card or found yourself frighteningly deep in debt, join the club. How did we get here, and what do we do about it? Our guest this hour is psychologist Stuart Vise. He's an expert on irrational behavior, and he's the author of a new book called Going Broke: Why Americans Can't Hold On to Their Money. Stuart, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
You know, two or three generations ago, Americans prided themselves on their frugality. I mean, I bet folks listening had a grandparent who boasted of being able to stretch a dollar. And now we seem to have become a nation of consumers who are just incapable of thrift. What happened?
Well, it's become a very fast-paced consumer economy. Our economy thrives on moving dollars in and out of households, and it's a very different culture now. There is too much emphasis on immediate satisfaction, and unfortunately, it's way too easy to satisfy your whims as quickly as possible by clicking away money at every chance. And of course, there's plenty of credit available for people who don't have the money on hand.
Are there really that many Americans going broke, do you think?
Absolutely. The bankruptcy rates have been very high prior to the 2005 bankruptcy bill, which made it much more difficult to declare bankruptcy. But rates are coming back up again, and I think it's just a matter of time before they're as high as they were before. Of course, the foreclosure crisis is the latest thing, and it represents, I think, just another way in which Americans are springing a leak. They can't pay their bills, and so they've let the biggest bill of all go, and they're losing their homes as a result.
You collected interviews with a lot of people who filed for bankruptcy over the last few years. Tell me about some of the people you met. You know, how did they happen to hit bottom?
Well, a number of them had, and this is a very common sequence, is that they were going along fine, making a good salary, and had gradually built up debt. Credit card debt is the primary problem, and then they hit some kind of bump in the road where their income stream was interrupted, and they couldn't keep it going. One young woman I spoke to was living with her mother, and the two had worked out an arrangement living in a condo together, splitting the bills, and so on. And it was a very comfortable setup for the two of them. And then suddenly, and really without any notice or any warning at all, her mother died, and she could not keep things going, and she ended up having to declare bankruptcy. There were many stories of situations like that where you tend to think, well, I'm always going to have this income, things are going to be okay, and in the background is this debt that has been built up over time, and that's all well and good as long as the monthly income stream remains constant. And it's a problem when it doesn't.
I think that probably the majority of Americans hear stories like that and think, well, that would never happen to me. you know, because I'm careful or I'm not going to get in debt like that. But I think the message of some of the stories you collected, you know, the sort of underlying message is this could be any of us.
It's true. It's true. You know, this is still a taboo. People don't talk about their financial portfolios. It is a bit more common to complain about the fact that you're in debt and that you're making these payments and that it's difficult to make the payments. But generally speaking, we don't really know what's going on behind the doors of our neighbors' homes in terms of finances. Part of the purpose of the book and the interviews in particular was to take these people, you know, out from the shadows and describe circumstances in which normal people, good people, find themselves in circumstances that are difficult to get out of. I think there's a stereotype of the person who is who gets into financial trouble as being irresponsible. Sometimes deliberately irresponsible, where they run up their bills and then deliberately try to get out from under them by declaring bankruptcy. This is the kind of stereotype that's been promoted by the banking industry. The reality is that the people who are declaring bankruptcy are generally on the lower end of the income curve. They're faced with uncertain incomes, oftentimes no health care coverage, and they have a very unfortunate story of trying to make ends meet, working hard, but then being hit by an unexpected downturn in their portfolio.
Well, the other thing is that, you know, we're very moralistic about money. I mean, we have... you're a psychologist, so you're coming at this from a specific perspective, and you're interested in human behavior and in our feelings about money, not just the actual what we do with it. There's a story you tell in your book about a guy who wrote a piece for Harper's some years ago. And it's a story you often give your students to read, and they have really very different reactions. You want to describe that?
Yes, this is Vince Pizarro, who is a writer for the for Harper's. He's on the staff there. He wrote a very good novel, and he's fairly well known. But he sort of broke the taboo and described his home and his life in Manhattan. He and his wife, he said, make $100,000 a year. He said he also had over $60,000 in debt, and he, despite living in an apartment, he didn't have a mortgage, so that was just other kinds of debt, and he said that he had spent the money primarily on his children, that he paid for private education for his kids, that he did not live an extravagant life. He described his couch as being this sort of beat up thing that they'd had for years and years, and yet he was totally in debt, and the creditors were calling on the average of about 15 times a week, wanting payment, and he couldn't pay his bills. He had his car impounded once. He was stopped by a policeman and literally had the car towed away from him, and he had to walk to work.
And this is not a guy who's working, three minimum wage jobs to try to make ends meet. This is a guy who's a writer for some of the top magazines in the country. How do your students respond?
Well, they have, as I describe in the book, they have sort of a mixture of responses. The most common response is that he is irresponsible, that he's a bad person, that he should move to the suburbs where he could get cheaper education for his kids, and that they think that he's bad because he's also setting a bad example for his children.
Mm-hmm.
Other students are more kind-hearted and suggest that he's doing it for a good purpose. He's trying to be a good parent. And it's difficult to live in New York and so on. But it is an interesting Rorschach test for people who read it. When the article was published in Harper's, it was the response in the mail was something like a record-breaking response of letters, and most of the letters to the, you know, responding to this article did call him, you know, all sorts of names and said that he was irresponsible. So this is why it's a taboo to talk about these things. This is why there's shame associated with it, and yet even in his case may be, you know, not as in some ways, you know, his decisions, he admits that his decisions were not always good. But I think some of the other people that I mentioned in the book have even more of a case where it's less their fault. We really can't hold them as responsible. And I think that's often the case, is that people get into this these problems gradually, making, you know, small decisions, and then the world is uncertain. The world is, unfortunately, our economy is much less stable for individual workers than it used to be. And as a result, if you're living on credit, you are very vulnerable to anything that comes along.
Well, and I think, you know, the story of the writer from Harper's is an extreme one, but kind of illustrates the fact that we all feel guilt. You know, even those of us who are thankfully not $60,000 in debt, you know, feel some guilt when the bills arrive and you've got a, you know, maybe you can pay that credit card off, maybe you can't. You know, I think it's very few of us who don't feel a certain amount of financial shame these days. And I'm kind of curious about how we got here. You know, partly one of the interesting things your book does is sort of say, you know, not all of this is really our fault. It's not just that we're immoral, greedy people. It's, you know, there's specific reasons why we got overextended.
Right. And it's also, you know, of course, it's easy to blame the credit card companies and the banks, and that is you know, especially now, is something that is appealing to do, and I do blame them in part for what's going on. But it's not that simple. There's more to the story, and that is that in the last 30 years, our culture and our economy has changed drastically, and I give the, you know, one anecdote that sort of sums it up is the story, you know, the idea that when I was in college, if I wanted to buy a new record album, I had to get up, put my clothes on, go downtown, and go into a store, and the store had to have the album in place, you know, in stock, and I had to have cash. I had to have either cash or a check that was backed up by cash to buy it. Today, my students can buy any album under the sun, whether they have cash or not, in about, you know, 30 seconds. And it's very unlikely that they're going to be interrupted in that process or that they're going to have second thought.
I'm talking with psychologist Stuart Vise. He's the author of Going Broke, Why Americans Can't Hold On to Their Money. It'll be out in just another week or so. I'm Ann Strangehamp, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Treating you cool, I'm putting you down, but baby, I don't intend to leave empty-handed. Give me some money.
We're talking about going broke this hour and why Americans have so much trouble holding on to their money. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'll welcome your calls. Toll-free number is 800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, you can dial 263-1890. If you've got questions, comments, personal experience getting into or out of debt, techniques for savings you want to pass on, we're talking with psychologist Stuart Vise. And Stuart, we've got a few people who've been waiting to talk to us. Eugene and Viola, hi.
Good morning. I grew up right after World War II, and from first grade till fourth grade, I got 25 cents a week for an allowance. From fifth grade until eighth grade, I got 50 cents a week. And by the time I had finished seventh grade, I sold Clovering Salve, and I also drove the tractor during harvest for the gentleman guy we rented from. But when I finished seventh grade, I had $50 in the bank. And out of that, besides having that, I'd also bought a real nice Model 25 Daisy BB gun. And I had my expenses. Now, my mother instilled in me and us boys just one thing. First, you pay yourself, no matter what or how little it is. And you do it. And my father, when he would buy a car, he never wrote a check all of his life. I don't think he wrote over 3 or 4, and he lived to be almost 90. But everything he did in cash. Now, yesterday, I had to put new brakes in my car. The total bill was $240. I paid for that in cash.
Great.
And I bet they were surprised. I bet they were surprised at the garage.
Yeah, but I paid for it in cash. And yeah. if I haven't got it, I don't spend it. And I still pay, even though sometimes, a few times around, I've had dire financial straits. But I've always managed to lay, and I don't care if it's just $3 or $4, lay that aside. Yeah. In other words, build a habit. Build a habit of paying yourself first. I don't care if it's a couple bucks in a week's time.
Eugene is right on the money, so to speak. No, this is really something that has gone out of fashion. Saving is almost a dirty word now. We live in a consumer society where the economy depends on people not saving. Depends on people spending as quickly as possible. You know, we're about to get a stimulus package for the economy coming from the President and Congress, and what they want is to put cash in the hands of people who will immediately turn around and spend it. And you know, 9/11 happens, and we're supposed to go out and buy things. The problem is that we, as individuals, we really do need to save. We need to have savings to be able to do the things that Eugene is talking about. So many people I spoke to were, for example, dependent upon cars to get to work, and they had no savings, and they got a big bill for a car repair, and they had to put it on their credit card. You know, they had no other choice. So being able to put aside money on a regular basis and create savings is so important for individuals.
But you know, the thing is, we know that. Like, we've been told that for years and years since we were little. We all know that we should be saving, you know, and we're inundated at our workplaces or, you know, at the bank with ways we could save, you know, 401k programs and education programs. There are lots of ways to save. It's just hard.
Well, I would argue that there actually aren't as many ways to save as there should be or could be, and that the emphasis is actually not on savings anymore in our society. For example, you mentioned 401ks. You know, retirement saving used to be sort of automatic. There used to be what we called, you know, defined benefit pensions, and now it's defined contribution. In other words, the responsibility is put back on the worker to make those payments in savings. And one of the problems is that if savings doesn't happen automatically, if it isn't built into the system that people are going to save, then it's less likely to happen, especially in a consumer society when there's so many other things that we are, you know, trying that are tempting us from you know, morning, the minute we wake up until the minute we go to bed. So we really do need to make more mechanisms for people to save easily. Unfortunately, many economists would tell you that's going to hurt the economy. Mm-hmm. If everybody was like Eugene, unfortunately, the economists would tell you that the economy would suffer. My argument is that the economy as a whole may suffer, but we shouldn't be tapping out people as individuals for the good of the quote economy. Their personal economies are also important.
So we're basically living in a culture in which we're inundated by temptations to spend immediately, and it is easier than ever to spend fast and to overspend. And at the same time, we're given no particular incentive and no easy ways to save.
Absolutely. I don't know if you've looked at the interest rates at savings accounts lately, but they're like 1% and 2% interest. It's terrible, and the opportunities for saving are just not there.
Mm. I want to go next to Chris, who's been waiting. He's in Burlington. Hey, Chris.
Hi, good morning. I apologize for background noise here. I'm driving along. I'm so glad the guest has a psychological background. I'm remembering back when I was younger, they talked about when there was an instance at the movie theaters where, I don't know if this is true or not, but, you know, in the beginning of the movie or whatever, during the previews, they'd flash popcorn really quickly up there, and it was subliminal. You couldn't
right.
see it, but it was there. And I feel like the marketing agencies and the marketing that is done to us is really a psychological attack, and it would make that kind of a situation like with the popcorn seem infantile, basically, because they've fine-tuned their marketing, and they play us like an instrument. They know exactly which strings to pluck and get us to feel that there's a need there that there's a perceived need that isn't really there, but emotionally we fall for it. And I'm going to hang up and listen on the radio.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for the call. Stuart, how sophisticated is the marketing efforts to get us to spend more than we can really afford?
Well, they're very sophisticated, and part of it is the technology that we have now means that we can be confronted with advertising in all sorts of different places where we never saw it before, on the internet, on our cell phones, you know, on television, of course, in the movies. He mentions the movies, and of course product placement in movies and TV is the latest defense against the mute button or TiVo. You know, because we can TiVo past commercials, they've put the products right in the movie where it's hard to escape them. So they're, the advertising and the commercialization of our world is a huge part of it. It's very difficult now. I mean, unless you literally close your eyes and you can't, it's hard to be in an environment where there isn't some advertising or brand name or something else that is part of the commercial world that's in your face. And
you
of
know,
course,
I know a lot of us grew up with that, though, and I think like to think that we're, you know, savvy enough consumers that we can weed out the advertising and, you know, see it and ignore it. We know we're being sold. I guess I think in some ways the more insidious thing that's happened is what you pointed out, this instant gratification is now possible in a way it never was before.
Yes, that's true. I mean, the major sort of message of the book is this challenge on our self-control that never existed before and that now is our daily struggle, there's always a moment when you can make a purchase. And it used to be that when you went home at night, you were pretty much free. You couldn't spend any money at home. It was a refuge, and you could do other things, and you didn't have to think about whether or not you should buy X, Y, or Z. Today, there really is no respite. You can make a purchase, you know, on the subway. You can make a purchase at any time, and so therefore, if temptation, you know, looms, you are forced to sort of struggle against it, and that is our problem. In addition to the fact that there's plenty of credit available for people who don't have the cash on hand, and that makes it possible to satisfy temptation even when you don't have the money.
You cite some interesting psychological studies that kind of play up just why it's so hard for us to resist instant gratification. I wondered if you could tell us about a couple. There's one that you do with your students. You offer them an envelope with $10 or one with $12?
That's right. Yeah, this is a little demonstration that shows how immediate gratification can change our preferences for things that we're presented with. So I ask my students, you know, which would you prefer, an envelope with $10 in it or an envelope with $12 in it? And you're going to get it, both, either one you get right now. And, of course, you know, they look at me like I'm crazy, and they say, I'd take the $12, please. You know? And so then I say, okay, but let's change the situation and say that you can have the $10 right now, or you can have the $12 in a week. And generally, people still want the $12. But as I move it out in time, there comes a point where they say, "Oh, what the heck? Give me the $10 now. I don't want to wait for the $12." And usually, by the time I get to 2 or 3 weeks, they shift over. But then, if I hold that gap constant of let's say 2 weeks, right, and move them both out into the future, and say, well, what if I offer you $10 in 10 weeks? And $12 in 12 weeks, you know, so that now they're both
far away.
They're both far away, but the distance between the two remains what it was before. In that case, they switch back and want the $12. At that point, they're both out in the distance, and they want the larger amount. So our preferences, you know, are basically the book is largely about the problem of long-term versus short-term thinking. You know, when we think in the long term, we are wise. We want the $12. We want to have a retirement account that is going to be adequate. We want to have savings that will protect us against rainy day. It's the problem is that wise long term thinking person has to coexist with a very impulsive person who is confronted with choices on a daily basis and tends not to think, you know, in the same way, and it's the struggle between those two selves that are, you know, within all of us.
But it's like life has become a game show, you know, where you take the money in suitcase 11 now or the one you have in your hands.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay, we've got Pat on the line from Sparta. Hi, Pat.
Good morning, Ann, and good morning to your guests.
Hi.
Hi.
I kind of wanted to relate a little story about our past, about saving, and how easy it is to. It reminds me a lot of like trying to go on a diet.
Mm-hmm.
My wife had gone back to. We had a young daughter. I think she was 6 months old at the time, and my wife had decided to leave her job. I was working full time and go back to school. And about 3 months in, I lost my job, and. We were kind of forced to cut the fat. I was able to work from home and watch our daughter. We couldn't afford daycare anymore, but I was able to freelance from home, and she continued through school, and we made it. It was 2 years, and we did it. We you know, gutted our house of anything we didn't need and got rid of, you know, cable and all these superfluous, you know, money drains, And we made it through. And then when she got back to work, we just kind of slowly drifted back to, you know, the way we were, you know, the way we used to be. And now we're just constantly battling that. Every few months we'll say, okay, we've got to stop this. We got to do this and this and this. We have to, every time we go to the grocery store, we have to make a list. We can't, you know, deviate from that. We'll do that for a couple weeks. And then a few months later, we'll find ourselves doing the same thing, and it's just, you know, I used to work in advertising, and I know all the, you know, I know the game, but, you know, you just feel like it's like a drug, you know, you have to go out and get the latest and newest, and, you know, the albums I have on iTunes are old now, and I need new ones, and it's just hard to, it's hard to stick with it.
Yeah.
I think it's growing up in front of the TV. I think that's a lot of it. You know, I grew up in the 70s in front of the TV. And
right.
Yeah, well, like a lot of us.
This is a good story, Pat, and you folks deserve credit for doing that. I don't mean, you know, credit. I mean credit. But for getting through this. But one of the things that's interesting about your story is that you were in a position where I know it wasn't easy, but you were in a position where you could make adjustments to bring your expenses down in a way that would get you through this difficult period. And unfortunately, and part of that was because there were two of you, right? One could go home and take care of the kids and so forth, and it worked out well that way. Unfortunately, some people are in a situation where they've and of course they've made decisions that put them there, but but they're in situations where they don't have that ability to adjust anymore. They may be, you know, you may be a single person with a mortgage, and your mortgage is basically the big deal. And then if you hit a bump in your income, you know, you're just out. Or many couples, one of the interesting theories that has been proposed is that many couples move into neighborhoods that are expensive in order to get into good schools for their children. This is a theory put forth by Elizabeth Warren that they become dependent upon two incomes in order to sustain this household in an expensive suburb to get good schools for their kids. And then what happens if one of them loses their job or experiences a downturn in income? They find it difficult to make those adjustments. Now, you were able to do it, and that's great. But
hey, Pat, I have a question. Are you still there?
Sure. Yep.
Yeah. When you were going through the period of time when, I mean, I know things were really hard, but there was a period of time when you just couldn't buy a lot of the stuff that you can afford to buy now. It just wasn't an issue. So do you think that in some weird way you were happier then than you are?
I tell people all the time the best summer of my life was when it was that same summer after I lost my job is our TV was broken. The picture wouldn't come on, and we couldn't afford, you know, at the time to pay for cable or dish or whatever we had at the time. So we just let it go, and we'd listen to the radio. You know, I always have NPR on, and you know, so I always had that on, and we spent time talking together, you know, and went for walks. And
Josh, I wish I had met Pat earlier. I could have put him in the book because he's like telling all the points of my book. Yeah, that is true. You know, all this bombardment and all the choices that we have, we tend to think of choice, you know, consumer choice or any kind of choice as an unqualified good thing. It's good to have more choices. Well, the fact of the matter is that sometimes we're happier when the world is simpler, when we don't have to think about whether we want X, Y, or Z. And I think that's sort of what Pat is saying, is that you know, shutting down a little bit can be very satisfying.
We're talking with psychologist Stuart Vise. He's the author of Going Broke, Why Americans Can't Hold On to Their Money. It's a book that'll be out in bookstores in another week or so. I'm Ann Strainchamps, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up in the next hour, speaking of hunger, our next subject will be a short history of the American stomach. I'm Ann Strainchamps, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, and we're talking with psychologist Stuart Vise. Right now, we're talking about going broke and why Americans can't hold on to their money. And Stuart, I wanted to, I should give the phone number too. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234 in the Madison area, 263-1890. You can email us. It's talk@wpr.org. If you've got personal experience getting into or out of debt, techniques for savings you want to pass on, or you have a question you want to ask, feel free to join us. Stuart, I want to get back to that thing we were talking about, the connection between affluence and happiness, because there's been, you know, over the last few years, some really interesting research showing that as American affluence has climbed, actually Americans' happiness levels have declined. You know, we tend to think being able to buy more, being more affluent will make us happy. You know, it doesn't. In fact, the reverse. It seems to be making us unhappier. Does your own research suggest why?
Well, I don't, not exactly, but I would say that I've seen that data, and I think there's some real truth to it. The thing is that, you know, I don't think that the satisfaction of life comes from things, ultimately. We do want things, and we are tempted by things, but But I do believe that the real satisfaction of life comes from non-material relationships and activities, and I think that we forget that. I think that we realize. I mean, the story that Pat told about that summer when the TV was broken. I think that, you know, that sums it up. That we live in a very complicated, busy, noisy world at the moment, and there is a movement on to sort of simplify, to get rid of the trappings, the branded world that we live in, the commercial world that we live in, and to sort of figure out who we are again, and talk to one another, and cook, and have meals together, and not engage in all this spending.
And I think the other point is that, you know, we think having more choice is good and will make us happier, whereas often having more choice makes us feel simply stressed out. I mean, you have a little vignette in your book, a story of like two hypothetical young men who are both trying, well, they're both tempted by an iPod, you know,
right,
like a $300-$400 iPod. The first kid, Jim, a young man, can't afford it, but he could stretch, or he could
right,
buy it on credit. You know, he could do this, even though it's really not a wise decision. The second hypothetical young man, Jim, really doesn't have credit, can't afford this at all. It's just not even in the cards. Who's happier?
Exactly. Yeah, I would argue that the fellow who can't make the purchase at all is happier. And you know, how many of us have been in that situation? You know, almost daily, where you're in a commercial environment, you say to yourself, "Well, I could get this. I could do this. Should I? Should I not?" You know, and of course, the fact that we all have plastic in our pockets is part of the story of those two young men. Is that we are forced into making difficult decisions about going beyond our means because we all have credit available. At least many people are. And that's not a happy world. I would argue that's not a happy world to be in. And that the people who don't have as many choices, in some cases, are happier, as long as their basic needs are taken care of and so on, that they have enough money to live on. But part of the message of the book is that more choice is not always good, and this is something that Barry Schwartz has written a whole book on this topic as well, so it's not new with me, but it's definitely true that we have lots of choices. The other word that is a dangerous word in our world is convenience. You know, every time you hear someone say it's really convenient to do X, there's often a financial cost associated with that. Things that are easier to do are done more often. If those things involve the spending of money, then spending is going to happen more often. Buying on the internet, the whole sort of self-service big box store thing, where we can all very easily go and get whatever we want and haul it home quickly. That's a whole new thing that has happened and has made it so that it's convenient to be separated from your money.
Karen from Darlington is on the line. Hey, Karen.
Good morning. What an interesting program. I'm old enough to remember when we did not receive 1099 interest statements from our banks and our savings was exempt from taxes. Has this had anything to do with the buy-it-now mentality that we had?
Well, I think it's just another example of how our society has, you know, we reinforce spending and not saving. This is the basic problem. We are dependent upon a service and commercial economy, and that means that we have to buy and sell things from each other. We're not selling overseas. We're not manufacturing in the way we used to, and so. So the economy expects and depends on our, you know, being separated from our cash as quickly as possible. And savings has become, you know, I mean, there are people that save, but they do it on their own. It's not part of the culture. It's not encouraged in any way, in any really meaningful way. Quite the opposite. Spending is really, really encouraged.
And we've got Derek also calling from Round Lake, Illinois.
Yes.
Hey, Derek.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for a good program. As a journalist, I've traveled past 2 years to China, India, and Eastern Europe. And what I see is really happening is the same level of the economic development, what's happening in the U.S. as far as the credit industrial complex is concerned, and as well as in the United States and those countries, increasingly credit is being used as an element of social, economic, political control, specifically making people working like 24 hours a day, get themselves into meaningless debt, by the same token giving up their freedom, giving up their own self sense of political participation in democracy. And it also is getting to the point where, you know, this is really the degree of total dissolution of the feeling of guilt, shame, and stigma to having credit, having debt, which by the same implication, person gives up his own personal freedom, also personal degree of democratic participation, is really not being researched by any major American or European psychological institutions, because I think there's a definite correlation between how the society evolves, specifically into these different societal problems, lack of participation, political apathy, whatever, and the degree of increased consumerism. And it's the question I would have to your guest is simply, why is the psychological establishment not conducting exact studies, specifically when I wrote about that for foreign media, which there's a definite correlation between what's really happening within the society and why just nobody really why media is doing such a poor job to bring those really big picture issues to the foresight.
Stuart?
Good question. I can't give you an answer, but I really think you're on the money there. I think that there is, in fact, a problem in the sense that as a society becomes more commercial, it becomes less involved in other things. I think that's borne out in our own society as well, that there's sort of an apathy about social issues for the most part that comes from, you know, this sort of self-gratification that goes on, and that is the norm now. You know, it is normal to satisfy your every whim and to be obsessed with things commercial and material, and so the other part of your story is this business of being sort of a slave to your debt, and that is very true, I think, in our society as well, that people are working two and three jobs to get by. Some of this is just economics, that they're not being paid adequately in any of those jobs, and that's an issue too, but people are strapped and becoming, you know, having to take on all this extra work in order to maintain their jobs and their debt and pay for their health care and so on.
You know, there's another piece of psychology that I think might kind of play in here, and it's the research that people like Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi have done on flow, on how people, basically, how people experience pleasure in their daily lives. Because I was thinking that, you know, part of what you're saying is that immediate pleasure, immediate gratification always trumps, you know, a longer-term gratification or longer-term pleasure. And, it, you know, so that's part of the allure, the appeal of shopping. And I was in my 10-year-old's fourth-grade classroom recently and listening to some of the kids talk about things they do in their families for fun, and I was really, really struck by how many kids say, well, my family likes to go shopping for fun. I mean, this is like, sure, some kids said we go skiing or, I don't know, we do other things, we do puzzles together, but really, like, half the kids said my family likes to go shopping together. And I thought, you know, a lot of other leisure activities are harder to get into. They involve, you know, some investment. It's easy to go to the mall, hang out, walk around, buy a couple of things. It's harder to strap on the skis and go outside or learn a hobby.
Right. Or go running or something like that. It's true. And shopping as a leisure time activity, it, you know, has always been there as a factor since actually the late 19th century, but it's become bigger and bigger and bigger, and of course now it can be done anywhere. You know, shopping. You know, the home shopping network is this, and QVC. These are at home leisure sort of entertainment merged with shopping, and they're expensive. These turn out to be some of the most successful cable channels on television. So, in terms of the money they bring in, you know, this is an issue. People, I mean, this is also part of that sort of simplifying movement, that people need to find longer-term, more simple and less expensive, less commercial ways of satisfying themselves, of finding satisfying leisure activities. We're pushed towards these other kinds of activities, unfortunately.
I want to take a couple more calls, and then I want to also ask you to give us a few prescriptions for things we can do. Diane in Madison, hi.
Hi. When I was a young girl, it was considered poor, if you didn't have a lot of clothes and such. And there's such a gap today between the rich and the poor. But I'm going to say that I don't have a TV, and I took my young girl concept, and I live it today. I don't buy into the hype. I don't have plastic. I ride the bus. I don't have a car. I don't shop at the big shop stores. And why do I feel happier? I see people walking around with packages, going to malls, and to me they don't look happy, like you said. And I'm a happy camper, and I don't have a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Thanks, Diane. Thanks.
Right. That's great. That's great. It's too bad that this is so unusual, that the norm is the busy shopper.
Well, let's run through, I mean, most of your book is kind of the psychology of how we got here and why we can't seem to get out of our current situation. But you do, near the end, have one chapter with a few very tangible, specific, practical suggestions. What are they?
Well, there are a number of them, and you can probably guess from what we said so far what some of them are. One of them is to kill your television set, and if you can, get away from try to keep the commercial world at bay, and so getting rid of television magazines that are more like catalogs and so forth. The other thing, there are ways to save. I also, by the way, suggest some social, larger social suggestions like restrictions on or regulation of the credit industry in general, which we definitely need. But for an individual, there are ways to make savings easier. Now in today's world, you have to sort of set it up yourself because nobody's out there doing it for you. But I recommend that people, if they can, set up a separate bank account that they don't use for their everyday expenditures, and that they have an automatic deposit into that account that goes into savings. And it's just forgotten about, and it's an account that is not used for anything else, and that if possible, you can also have bills, your recurring bills, paid automatically out of that account as well. So that
this was an idea. Yeah, you had the idea of keeping two separate bank accounts. One is basically for discretionary purchases, and the other is for non-discretionary. So you've got to kind of add up all the bills that you absolutely have to pay every month. There's no choice. Heating, phone, car, mortgage, whatever. All that comes out of one bank account. And you automatically put from your paycheck the amount that's going to need to be in there to cover it. So then you wind up with this little tiny discretionary bank account on the side from which you buy everything else.
That's right.
It's really very ingenious.
Well, I hope it's not too tiny, but yes, that's right. And the idea there is that you don't have this false sense that I have more money than I really have. I mean, the fact of the matter is that for most people who live, this way, most of their paycheck is spent before they ever receive it because they have these recurring expenses and so on. So the idea is to just sort of push that all aside. And by the way, included in that is an automatic savings deposit. That's one of the bills that should automatically be paid and be taken out of the discretionary. You don't want savings to be discretionary. You want it to be automatic and a given. But then what you're left with is the money that you can in fact spend, and what is in fact your discretionary income. And I think if we're able to separate out for ourselves clearly what I can choose to spend or not, and what really isn't is out of my hands, has to be spent, it's much easier to stay in the black.
I guess sort of bottom line, it's try to pay attention to, it's almost like we have two selves, you know, the self that wants the immediate gratification and the self that wants to go for long-term stability. So just try to listen to that second self a little bit more often.
That's exactly right.
Stuart, thanks so much for talking with us today. It's
been
my pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Stuart Vyse is a psychologist and author of Going Broke: Why Americans Can't Hold On to Their Money. And it'll be out in just another week or so. It's from Oxford University Press. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program, and thanks to Karen Prager for on-air production, and to Joe, who's manning the switchboard, I mean, the control board, whatever. The dials and knobs and things that go up and down. If you want a CD of this program, call the radio store. The number is 800-747-7444. I'm Anne Strainchamps in for Kathleen Dunn. We will be talking in just a few minutes about a short history of the American stomach. So I guess we're sticking with appetites today. And did I say that you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio? I hope so, because you are. Thanks for listening, and stay with us.